There's a lot of very innovative research going on relating to alternative energy sources. It's going on here at the UW-Madison, especially at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And today we're going to find out about some work taking place that can help to balance demands on our land for food production and generating alternative energy. John Greenler is Director of Education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, the GLBRC as we call it, and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. John, always good to see you.
It's great to be back. Thank you, Larry.
And with us as well, Brad Barham, who is a professor in the Department of Ag and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. He specializes in issues relating to technology adoption and public policy and structural change in agriculture, associated with the GLBRC as well. And his interests are in energy, in the arena of bioenergy and what is called ecosystem service provision, which I'm going to ask him about what that all means. And certainly, we're going to take your questions and comments as we move along today. You may have a question for them about renewable energy. How committed are you to using renewable energy? Would you pay extra or sacrifice some convenience if it was necessary to do that? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. Love to have you with us. And John, you were the one who kind of suggested we talk about the prospects for bioenergy crops on marginal lands in Wisconsin as a theme for today.
Sure.
Marginal lands, what are you talking about?
Yeah,
there?
What does that mean anyway? Right. It's really a lot of different things. When we look at our agricultural landscape, I think in Wisconsin, I think we really appreciate the variety that we see, the aesthetic, that's out there as we drive through our rural areas. And clearly some of that land is really prime for agricultural use in terms of annual crops such as corn and beans, soybeans. But there's also a lot of that land that we would categorize as marginal for any of a number of really a wide varying of reasons. One that's very common is that it's highly erodible. It might be on a steep slope, et cetera. And by going in year after year and plowing up that soil, planting new annual crops, et cetera, we really are create a vulnerability to losing a lot of that rich soil as a resource. Also, there's a lot of consideration in terms of hydrology and our waterways. If we have acreage which is close to our water systems, we're quite vulnerable to having fertilizer runoff, go into our streams and lakes, affecting kind of local quality, but also ultimately a lot of that fertilizer runs, down into the Mississippi through our watershed all the way to the Gulf of Mexico and actually creates significant environmental problems, what's known as the hypoxic zone down in the Gulf of Mexico, where essentially every year in the spring, large portions of that Gulf die from too much nutrient, essentially. So, but there are other reasons why we have sometimes it's just poor soil and really isn't highly productive for any number of different reasons, and that would be another kind of reason to categorize it as being marginal.
Yeah, and so we can use that marginal land.
Right. So, I mean, we want to be good stewards of our landscape resource. And, the question is, how can we utilize those areas in a way that is sustainable, that we're really not degrading, the soil and also wildlife, opportunities, all the other services, essentially, that these areas provide, habitat, but also nutrient cycling, water retention, the list goes on. And so clearly we have some, really excellent, programs that are out there now. The Conservation Reserve Program is a good example example of where farmers can take some of these marginal lands and put them into, essentially put them into a perennial planting to keep the quality of that landscape high. But there are opportunities where we might be able to achieve, the goals that the CRP, the Conservation Reserve Program, has, for example, and possibly also be, producing a crop, a perennial type crop in this instance, where we'd be getting biomass off that we could be using for conversion into fuels.
Yeah. Brad, you've been working on the GLBRC project as well. Talk about the aspects of what you've been studying.
So my main focus on this project has been to survey farmers and non-farm landowners to find out their willingness to participate in bioenergy crops, either on their prime croplands or their marginal lands. And so, this is a situation where lots of people can make prognoses about how we might use the land, but in the end of the day, in this country, land use choices are made by the people who live on the land, own the land, operate the land, and so we've been surveying farmers and non-farm landowners to find out what they think.
Now, have you learned some things so far yet?
Well, yes, we have, and I would say one of the primary things we've learned is that if we were to try to pursue a bioenergy future in Wisconsin, especially in the southern and central parts of the state, we would find it pretty difficult to secure much in the way of continuous land for the production of bioenergy crops. And maybe there's a very obvious reason we can start with in this conversation, and that is we have one of the best bioenergy facilities out on the landscape here in Wisconsin already, known as a dairy farm.
Yeah, and so farmers are a little reluctant, maybe?
Well, I think they have a good enterprise going, and a lot of the lands that John just described as being marginal are actually, pasture lands. Mm-hmm. They're lands that are used for long-term rotation, and so if you were going to attract them out of bioenergy into that, I mean, many of them already face a point where, in terms of their landscape or their land holdings that they have, they already maxed out in terms of the animals they have relative to the land they have in terms of being able to grow and provision the feed and forage they need for their animals. And that doesn't just apply to them. It often applies to their neighbors because oftentimes they're buying from, renting from, in relationship with their neighbors in terms of that land use.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we have callers online to visit with you. Let's go to Marcus in Minneapolis, I think, up first here. Marcus, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I am in the process of building a self-sustainable cabin using solar and wood for energy and rainwater. And I was wondering, why do not more people try to build self-sustainable living? What is the factor that holds people from doing such things?
Hmm. Well, I don't know, Brad, you probably haven't researched that.
No, I haven't. I have some ideas about the way in which what it costs to actually do that kind of thing and the kind of investment that you're making. But I think it's an interesting question. What's your experience been?
Well, definitely money. This prototype that I'm building costs a lot of money. But there are also cheaper ways. And, you do some investments, but then you don't have any utility bills. And if you plan it right, then you actually get money back if you produce energy and feed it back into the system. So, I don't know. Just looking into the future, one would think that we need a lot more self-sustainability to cut back on the resources that we're
using. Well, I think that's a very good point. And I think one thing we have going for us here in the upper Midwest is that we have a lot of landscape on which we do actually have a fair amount of energy resources in the form of wood and in the form of grasses. And I do think that in addition to the solar that you're talking about, that we do have that potential. But it's not that well understood. I don't think as somebody who studies energy, I couldn't right off the top tell you what it would cost to do what you're doing. And, I think that's fact of the matter is that that's not common knowledge.
Yeah. We're a little off topic, but what the heck? Just to chime in a little bit here in terms of some of the work we're doing in the Wisconsin Energy Institute is looking into what we call microgrid technology. Looking at how we can dynamically interface with our current energy system. And so clearly, there's the idea of, as an individual owner, you can, have some solar panels and be selling to the utility. There's frequently a scale issue there. It's difficult to be very efficient significant in terms of energy production at a homeowner scale. But when we begin to look at things like a whole community in an area or an academic or corporate campus, for example, actually being somewhat independent, being able to have larger solar arrays or wind turbines, there's a real opportunity to actually be more economical, but also to be self-sustaining and green as well, and more efficient because of a kind of scaling up one unit of size, so to speak. And so, I think in the future we're going to see a whole range of ways to kind of develop more independent type systems. And I think these microgrids type structures have a lot of promise in that area.
Marcus, thank you for calling. I want to give Chuck and Krivitz a chance. Anything may have a related question. Chuck, hi.
Hi. My question is related because what I'm considering in the future is using pellets and a biomass system to heat the home, but primarily to generate electricity first, and then use the waste energy as a heat resource to store that in big tanks of water. And I know there was some research done in Madison. It was coming out of Colorado originally. There were some people that developed one of these energy systems. And I wondered what kind of progress was made, because I think efficient use of the pellets is, efficiency is the 90% of the solution and 10% is the resource. So what's your opinion on that?
Sure. Well, once again, I think, you're considering some very innovative and once again kind of dynamic, type systems. And this does come back to what I was mentioning earlier in terms of, microgrid type systems. And part of what you're talking about in terms of electricity and heat, what we would call cogeneration, has a lot of potential. I think it's a little more challenging to do that at the homeowner scale. Just once again, the technology is expensive. And when you scale it down for a homeowner, I think it becomes less efficient. But when we begin to look at kind of regional or cluster type deployment of these technologies, they really do become viable. And, and in fact, when we look at what's going on in some of the countries in Europe, for example, we do see a lot more cogeneration. And we even see, for example, at the business scale, there's some really interesting examples even here in Wisconsin of biomass being pelletized on site. Various facilities are actually producing those kinds of materials, residue materials that could be pelletized and using that for heat in a commercial plant, for example.
Alternatively, there's a major paper mill up near Wausau, which is just getting ready to go online, using the sort of extra wood residuals and slash wood to burn it for electricity and heat, that they'll use the heat in their paper mill, and the electricity they'll put back on the grid could provide electricity for about 30,000 houses. So that's a form of bioenergy at a scale that, John's talking about at the commercial level, where the cogeneration gives rise both to the local heat use and the broader distribution of the electricity. And I think the kind of thing you're thinking about at your household level is the kind of thing we will see increasingly at the landscape level in these kinds of more scaled up facilities.
We're going to take a quick break to take a look at the news, weather, and find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet. And then we'll be back with our two guests to talk some more about bioenergy. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin is an innovator in many areas, and alternative energy, I think, is no exception. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're always happy to get an update on what's going on with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and our two guests can certainly fill us in on that. Brad Barham, one of our guests, is a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, specializes in issues relating to technology adoption, public policy, structural change in agriculture, and he's been associated with the GLBRC, or Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, pretty much right from the start, if I'm not mistaken. And his main interests are in energy, or in the area of bioenergy and service provision, ecosystem service provision. So great to have him along. And thanks for joining us today, Brad.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And John Greenler, he's always with us every other month or so. John directs the education for both the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Always great.
A pleasure.
Thank you so much. You may have a question as we talk about the prospects for bioenergy crops on marginal land in Wisconsin. We've actually dealt with a variety of issues relating to bioenergy already with our two guests. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And Don in Portage has been waiting, so let's go right there to Don. Thanks for waiting. Hello.
Yeah, hi there. See, these fellas, if they've been listening, paying attention to the television the last couple of weeks, the federal government is afoot to move back on the production of ethanol, and particularly as it relates to these quote-unquote marginal lands. They're saying it's more to be gained than looking at them from a different perspective than more production of corn, in which they're going to be looking forward to the reduction of.
Yep, and I can tell you right now that John and Brad both have followed that story. John, comment from you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so yeah, as many of the listeners have probably heard, the EPA has put out a proposal to reduce the amount of biofuels kind of projected for the future, both in terms of corn grain ethanol, but also in terms of advanced fuels. And you know, I think there's a number of different reasons for that. It's a very complex domain in terms of the decisions that are made about the renewable fuel standard. I don't want to get too far into the kind of the minutiae of that. But I think the big picture perspective, which is really important, is in terms of those marginal lands, that we really need to be very careful about what happens with those. And so when we do look at, you know, some of what's going on right now, for example, where we're seeing some of this Conservation Reserve Program land actually being taken out of that program and put into annual cropping for corn and the like, that's something that we really need to pay attention to and think about. How can we be creative in terms of providing opportunities for farmers to be financially successful, to be productive, but also to conserve, you know, the full dynamic of our landscape. Taking CRP land, Conservation Reserve land, and putting it into annual cropping, I think is really something that we want to avoid. But I think we also want to look towards the future and say, what's the full range of opportunities? So planting perennial type crops. So probably many of the listeners have heard about switchgrass, which is this native prairie grass that's an option for planting. In fact, many CRP plantings are currently in switchgrass, but essentially using a biomimicry type of approach. Can we, put crops, into these more marginal areas, these very sensitive places in our landscape, where we can be not only holding soil, but actually even building soil in the process, also sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere and into the soil, and then in a conservative fashion, in a very considered fashion, producing biomass for fuel as well. So we're distinctly talking about not planting corn on these marginal lands, but instead some of these very sustainable, productive type crops.
Yeah, yeah. So there you have it, Don. Thank you for calling. Carl in Crystal Lake, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. I was wondering about the situation there with the grasses, the ditch grasses along the county roads and highways. That seems like a no-brainer.
Well, I think the answer there would be there's lots of no-brainers if you have the market set up for actually moving grasses and other residuals into a bioenergy market. So in other words, if we were, as somebody asked earlier, pelletizing various forms of residuals from agriculture and wood and burning them, then ditch grass would be a possibility. But right now, really, those markets are still pretty nascent. And so until we get the markets up and running, I think the ditch grass is just another possible source. But it's a reasonable suggestion and one that could be looked at.
And one of the areas of research that we're involved in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is how can we economically convert this fibrous plant material? Also, listeners have probably heard of it being referenced in terms of cellulose-type material. Cellulose is a polymer that really makes up cell walls, that fibrous content. And a lot of our long-term, very basic research is how can we, you know, very efficiently and economically convert that fibrous plant material initially into sugars, and then from sugars we can go to any of a number of different types of fuel, whether it be ethanol or drop-in substitutes for gasoline or diesel or jet fuel. So as we can bring those prices down by developing new science, new technologies, that will really make a significant difference as well. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, there actually are, you know, there are researchers out there looking at what kinds of equipment, for example, we might need to use to actually harvest, those grasses that are growing on our roadsides, for example. And so there is agronomy-based research looking at exactly that area. These urban, residues, whatnot, can be of a lot of value when you add them all up. It's a question of how can we efficiently, get them, convert them, and then have a market for them as well.
You know, it strikes me as probably you're looking at a lot of small rather than one very large place where you're going to take all this grass or whatever. You're looking at probably a series of smaller type local, which you almost call local bread.
Well, that's certainly, if you look at what the landowners, farmers and non-farm landowners that we surveyed said, I mean, even those who are willing to grow the bioenergy crops on their land, we're not willing to grow it on all of their land. It would be a small portion, say 10-15%. And imagine they had that at two different parcels spread across their farm. So now you have the setup and take down maybe twice on one farm to do the harvesting. And then if you're going every third farm to do it, you get the idea it's a fairly fragmented and non-contiguous activity. You know, you're doing it a little bit here, a little there. And I think that's going to be one of the challenges for this sector as a whole, is where will you be able to find, enough of it in an aggregated place to make it economical. And that was one of the major concerns that came for me out of the survey, was seeing how fragmented on the landscape it's likely to be. And so finding economic ways to do that will be important, and it may actually not be all that possible in some situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, just last week I was over at Michigan State University, which is one of our partners in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, and one of the things I had the opportunity to do was visit a scale-up facility where essentially we're piloting the technology which would allow for kind of local first-step processing of that material, which would do a couple things. It would densify that material and stabilize it so it could be stored for a long time, essentially creating a pelleted type material, but not out of wood, but potentially out of this, be it grassy material from switchgrass or also things like corn stover coming, as an agricultural residue. And the model is that we would, have a number of these, very localized, initial processing facilities. That material could then either be stored locally or shipped as needed to a larger biorefinery, essentially, that could be making liquid transportation fuels. So
there we go. There was an article, just kind of a negative article, I thought, in the paper not just too long ago, mm-hmm. and sort of negative about, we're not making any progress.
Right.
And you certainly disagree with, you guys disagree with that.
Well, go ahead, Brad.
Well, I would say we do and we don't. And so I'll do the don't, and I'll let John do the do, okay. Which is, I think it's true. I mean, at one level, when I was 35 years ago, when I was an undergraduate, they were telling me that ethanol was cellulosic ethanol was 5 years away. And so 35 years later, I'm working on research and I'm telling people, well, maybe it's, just coming around the bend, but it's still mm-hmm. a few years away in terms of being a serious energy source. And I think to understand that, you have to understand the vagaries of the energy, markets and policy that this country has followed. And we've largely followed a line of policy centered around using fossil fuels in the form of, oil and natural gas and carbon. And we don't tax it much. And whenever we can find a new source, we go after it. And we're doing that right now. And so oil prices and natural gas prices have come down from where they were several years ago and made it less attractive again to do this kind of alternative energy source. So that's the agreement with the article. Now I'll let John do the disagreement.
Excellent. Yeah, and I think everything that Brad has mentioned, is really true. And then I think that, interestingly, and I think very critically, is that we really are on the cusp at this particular point in time. There are now 10 commercial scale plants that are set to open for cellulosic fuel production coming up in 2014. And we actually don't have one here in the state, but there will be one actually in Iowa. And they're even harvesting corn stover as we speak for conversion in liquid fuels. And that's really a first. But what's interesting about these 10 different facilities is actually that they're highly diversified. So from ranging to using corn stover in Iowa to actually forestry residues being used down in the southeast part of our country. And so different technologies, different sources of biomass, you know, that actually are going to commercial scale. I think one of the things that was unfortunate about that article was kind of the lumping of ethanol, of saying that all ethanol is bad. And it's really not the molecule ethanol per se, but how we produce that compound, you know, can really be a make or break deal in terms of whether it's sustainable or not. So I think, as the article pointed out justly, there are a lot of concerns about how much corn grain we produce in our country today, and we really need to be watching that very closely. But I think, you know, the good news is increasingly there are a number of different options that we have there that will allow us to, you know, initially maybe supplement that, but hopefully also begin to really come up with some meaningful alternatives to that type of production.
John in New London has a comment. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate the program. This is a subject we've heard about for a lot of years, and it just never seems to take off and get a foothold. I'm a farmer. I see it from the other side of the fence. I would love to be growing this crop. Basically, what it comes down to is show us the money. It's got to be a crop that's productive. And it's got to be financially viable in this market. You do what pays the bills, and you know we've been talking about planting switchgrass, and I have landlords that would love to see me producing it, but you don't do what doesn't pay the bills.
Yeah.
And it comes down to you have to have a home for it before you produce it.
John, you're exactly right, and that's exactly what basically. Both farm and non-farm landowners told us in the survey that right now it doesn't pay. Part of the reason it doesn't pay is because we haven't really put any of the environmental benefits that are associated with that into the payment scheme in a significant way. So, in other words, we're trying to make the market do all the work, where in actuality, if the market reflected the cost of producing fossil fuels, the cost of producing ethanol from corn in a reasonable manner, because we had the right either tax or subsidy policies in place, then we could make it bankable, but we haven't made it bankable yet. And so I don't blame you for not growing it. I know people have been sitting on the edge of that decision now for a number of years, and it's still not, in most cases, in this part of the country, a viable choice.
Yeah.
Another.
If it becomes viable, I think you'd be amazed at how fast it could take off, but it's got to pay the bills.
Yeah. Wow. That's very useful to hear your perspective as a farmer on that. So I really appreciate your calling in. Another dimension, everything that Brad said, I think, is right on track. Another interesting part of the story in terms of GLBRC is work that we're involved in actually putting the potential of modern agricultural breeding into switchgrass, for example. So most of the varieties of switchgrass that are being grown out there today are not very sophisticated, haven't been well developed. And so we have a faculty member here on the UW campus, Mike Kassler, in agronomy, who's doing amazing things, actually breeding new varieties of switchgrass, which, you know, we're talking about very significant increases in productivity in terms of just the amount of biomass that we're going to see per acre. And that will also help the farmer be more productive in terms of just getting more yield, from their acres. And we've done amazing things, with corn, but when you look at something like switchgrass in terms of breeding, we're really just, we're novices. We're just at the beginning stages. And luckily, we have the scientific knowledge to really make a lot of progress in a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
It really seems like we're pulling the dog by its tail rather than its leash. We need to be working on the end market a lot more than the actual production of it, because production will follow.
Right.
If it gets to the point that we can produce it profitably, production. The farmers in the country are very good at production. It is one thing we excel at, and if you make something profitable, we will grow it.
John, I couldn't agree more. I want to just say, though, that, you know, when I started working on this project about 5 or 6 years ago, there was going to be a bioenergy plant here right on campus at UW, and there were 11 slated around the state on basically public institutions that were going to go to using switchgrass and other forms of biomass to produce heat and light for major facilities. Like here on campus, we need heat and cooling for buildings, and then we could produce electricity, and some of it we could put back on the grid, as we were talking about earlier in the day. All those were canceled, and they were canceled by the newly elected governor of the state at that time. So it takes markets, but markets also come from a public commitment to developing new energy sources, and we have not been able to sustain that in order for the market to make its way back down to you. And that's not the only possible source of the market, but that would have been one source of a market that could have gotten this thing going. And then the learning and the institutions and everything that goes with new markets, you know, the chance for you guys to try it out and get more productive at it over time, all that would be underway. So we've kind of stalled out compared to where we might have been.
I think we need to move that dog in all possible manners. So
yeah, and if the renewable fuel standard gets cut, that obviously isn't pushing us in the direction we need to go.
No, you're right.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you, John, for calling. I really appreciate your input. We have Jim in Winnebago County up next. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. Speaking of commitment, the consumer that's going to actually install an alternative energy system really has to be committed, because when it really comes right down to it, the public utilities, the so-called public utilities, really have absolutely the vested interest in making sure that that does not happen. We just installed a 9,000-watt solar PV system, which should take care of our entire home and a shop. And what we learned is that we've cost us upfront about $31,000, and with the tax benefits and focus on energy credits, it brings it down to what I would say pretty reasonable, around $18,000 or something in that line. But some changes have taken place with regard to the Public Service Commission and allowing the utilities to now pay back only about 25% of what we would pay if we were buying electricity from them. So unless one really is committed to the idea of alternative energy, there's an awful lot going against the consumer, not the least of which is cost, but also our so-called public utilities.
I totally agree, again, and this is, gets back really to the last caller's question, too. He started off his question by saying he'd love to grow switchgrass, and probably that's in part because he thinks growing switchgrass on certain landscapes would be doing the right thing, not just potentially economically, but ecologically, environmentally, and maybe for other reasons as well. And so, and you're basically posing the same question in a different context. You're saying, I've done the right thing. I've made an investment in something that if I was being paid for its actual value when I sold it back to the electricity company, then it would pay off. But now they're willing to pay me 25 cents on the dollar for that. And why is that? And why is that? It was a political decision that, you know, the consumers didn't win and the utility companies did. But it could go the other way. And that's part of what we need to talk about, is how we get the Public Utility Commission to, in this sense, do the right thing.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Joanne in Jacksonport, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. This is so wonderful to hear people with such a great overview about how everything is so interconnected. I hate the fact that I heard the other day they might actually plow up some of the tall grass prairies out west. Hope that doesn't happen. And the idea of finding a way to reimburse farmers for their efforts and hard work, I would be happy to pay a couple more cents in tax on my gas. I think it's ridiculous of us to worry about whether we have to pay, you know, what we're paying now. We could pay a little more for gas to benefit from this alternative energy.
I mean, right on target. You guys all know the answers, as far as I can tell. A carbon tax would be a way to make it more, you know, rewarding to do the kind of things we were just talking about. It would make producing electricity or other kinds of fuel from fossil fuels more expensive. And a gas tax is, in a sense, a carbon tax. So, yes, you're right on target. I couldn't agree more. We could pay for things we want to push ahead for environmental and economic reasons by taxing the things that are really actually more expensive to us than we realize, like gasoline.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we're at a time when their public understanding on some of these issues is really changing quite quickly. And I think, ever increasing understanding of the full implications of global warming and climate change, I think are becoming quite apparent. And I'm really hopeful that as we look forward, that the public will get a better appreciation of some of these issues that we're dealing with, and be willing to put in to put in place what we need in terms of policies, so we're really balancing all the different needs that we have. So.
Yeah. Wow, there's so much we could talk about. Brad, just in the 30 seconds, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
For bioenergy? Well, I'm optimistic about its prospects as a way of doing things, and I'm pessimistic about our political will at this time to push forward. I mean, I like what John just had to say. I actually think he's right. The public is much more aware, but I'm quite skeptical of the political system's ability to execute on that. In other words, I think the gridlock we have at both national and state levels on making meaningful policy changes is really holding us back as a state and a country.
Guys, thank you so much. We'll do this again in a month or two. We'll come back. Thank you so much, John Greenler.
Thank you,
Larry. Yeah, thank you, John Greenler and Brad Barham, our guests from the UW, and involved with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Thanks for listening.